Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. In the past few years here in California, megafires, drought, and pollution in our big cities have been a sobering reminder of the dire economic and human costs of climate change. But there is a slow-moving and much less visible disaster that will have devastating impacts on California residents and our way of life. And it may not grab the headlines like other climate change-related disasters. We're talking about sea level rise and its economic, social, and environmental impacts on the California coast. And to join us to discuss this issue, we are pleased to have Rosanna Shaw, an environment reporter covering the California coastline for the Los Angeles Times, calling in. She joins us for the first half hour on the show from Los Angeles. Welcome, Rosanna.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. We're going to open the phone lines in about 10 minutes or so. And that number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can email us now at yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. You can also post comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. So we do want to hear from you. But, Rosanna, let me start by just telling listeners that you wrote a special report for the Los Angeles Times recently that did a very in-depth job examining sea level rise and the future of our disappearing coastline. I just want to read a section of what you wrote. You wrote that the rising ocean for decades had spared California. Much of the state's coastal development took place in the years after World War II during the less stormy period of a climate cycle known as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Favorable winds pulled warmer water offshore, and the West Coast had cool, denser water that took up less volume, suppressing the rate of sea rise below the global average. But scientists in the last decade have seen a dramatic shift. The waters off the West Coast are now much warmer. The sea is now rising faster here than anywhere else in the world. And so it's a very powerful piece. I definitely would commend it to listeners. But what inspired you, Rosanna, to do this investigation and to write this piece?
Yeah, thank you. When I started covering the coast, I mean, sea level rise was just this one issue that seemed to loom over every city I went to. And what was interesting was everyone I talked to seemed to acknowledge the problem. It wasn't like there was any denial on climate change or sea level rise. Everyone I spoke to said, yes, the water is rising, but everything that we've built and love about our coast, home, Pacific Coast Highway, beaches, all of it is fixed in place with nowhere to go as the water moves inland. So what do we do about this? That question kind of was what got everyone stuck. And I listened to people argue over and over again what options that they had. So I guess my hope going into the story was to really get people to understand the big picture, see that this debate, this existential argument was happening in all these different communities with very similar themes up and down California. And just to help people understand all the stakes and why people feel the way that they do. You know, I went into the story really wanting to find a solution, but the reality just turned out to be so much more complicated. I think we see this with climate change in general. Climate change really means changing a lot of what we're comfortable with, and it just doesn't get easier the longer that we wait.
And so you say you heard up and down the coast fear of sea level rise, acknowledgement of the problem. So was this bipartisan? I mean, is this even people who maybe don't accept the science about human-caused climate change, they still are focused on this issue?
Yeah, I think rising water, it's a slow-moving disaster. You hear that a lot. But I think people do see it, especially those who have lived along the coast for, you know, generations. And, you know, the debate wasn't as much, is it happening? It was more, what do we do about it, and how much time do we have? I think some people might say that this is something we don't have to think about for another few decades, and other people say this is something we should have done and started working on 2 decades ago. So I think the timing element and also what exactly it means to adapt to sea level rise is the core of the debate.
Well, let's talk about the timing. It's the science on this is very alarming. So the science tells us that in the last 100 years, the sea has risen about 9 inches, maybe a little bit less here in California. But by the end of the century, the surge could be greater than 9 feet. And can you describe a bit about the science, what some of these projections are, and also what the consequences are going to be for our coastline? I mean, I'm sure we can all imagine a 9-foot sea level rise and how disastrous that could be. But let's get into some of the specifics on that, too.
Yeah, the numbers are startling. I mean, you mentioned the sea level rise suppression that spared the West Coast for many decades during our key eras of development. And, you know, 9 inches total in the last century in California versus 9 feet possibly by the end of the century, that's you know, pretty eye-opening. And, yeah, a good question. I mean, I get this a lot. You know, why is the sea rising? We think about glacial ice melt, but kind of my spiel to people at dinner is usually, if you break it down, around 45% of sea level rise has occurred because the ice sheets and mountain glaciers are melting. And then another 45% is happening because the ocean has expanded as its waters have warmed. I mean, a lot of global warming, the ocean is what's absorbing all this heat, and warm water expands. And the final 10% or so comes from the drawdown of groundwater aquifers, such as, you know, taking water from the Central Valley for our crops. And all that water also eventually makes its way through streams and into the ocean. So if you put all this together, it really does kind of paint the big picture of why the sea is rising. And then, you know, keep in mind that we were spared kind of the brunt of it for many decades, and now we are seeing higher and faster rates of rise along the coast of California.
And so how likely is 9 feet? I mean, I've heard there's different scientific estimates. Some are on the lower end of that, but some are actually much worse. And it seems like to date, we've actually been doing worse than what the climate projections had sort of originally modeled. So what's the range here, and what seems to be the most likely based on your reporting?
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. I mean, as an environment reporter, I feel like every other month I'm getting a new study that says it's going to get worse. I don't think I've seen a study in quite a while that says it's going to be less crazy than we last projected. But, you know, just to be fair, let's give the full range. I mean, we can safely say we can anticipate 2-ish feet of sea level rise by the end of the century based on current projections. But a lot of scientists that I've talked to say those numbers may be too conservative. And a lot of it is just this uncertainty with the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is as large as a third of the U.S. And that ice sheet is becoming more and more unstable from warming ocean waters underneath it. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not this ice sheet will suddenly collapse or melt. And if it were to disintegrate, we'd have up to an additional 11 feet of sea level rise. But I haven't seen that number out in public a lot. That is like the worst case scenario. But it is no longer out of the realm of possibility when we talk to scientists. And I think I stuck with 9 feet because state planning officials in California recently adopted 3 meters, so a little bit more than 9 feet, as the high end of their range to officially plan for in all of their documents when they talk about sea level rise and what they're anticipating by the end of the century.
So the worst case scenario so far seems to be 20 feet sea level rise.
9 feet, maybe 11 being the worst case scenario.
Okay, so you weren't saying 11 feet beyond the 9 feet, just 11 feet of
no,
the West Antarctic.
11 feet total, 9 feet being kind of the safer, higher end to say publicly, because that's what state officials are planning for in their documents.
All right, well, let's talk about consequences, because your article did a really great job going in depth on some of the cities along the coast that are grappling with this issue. But can you just describe what this is going to mean for California's coastal communities and for the state at large?
Yeah, I think one concept that I found really helpful is just this idea of coastal squeeze. So think about, as the water is rising, you know, we don't have to talk about how fast or, you know, how long, but just imagine the water slowly creeping up along the coast, and then everything is kind of fixed in place, like Pacific Coast Highway, Great Highway, Highway 101. They're not moving further inland as the water is going up. Our homes are not moving inland. So as the water moves further inland, what is getting squeezed out? Right now, it's beaches, it's salt marshes. There was this fantastic study last year by USGS and UCLA that found that all salt marshes along the Pacific coast will go extinct as an entire ecosystem by the end of the century if we don't change our ways because of this coastal squeeze. And, you know, we're facing kind of loss of beaches if we don't think about what it means to not move hard infrastructure out of the way as the water moves inland. So, you know, when we talk about sea level rise adaptation, you know, coastal scientists, planning experts, all the kind of experts that I spoke to, they all ended up saying that it sounds like you have a lot of choices, but you only have so many when it comes to facing this squeeze. One is to defend the coastline in place, build more seawalls, add more hard infrastructure, just kind of make sure that everything that we care about that is human built, we keep that defended in place and just allow the sea to keep moving up on it and forget whatever gets squeezed out in between. Another option is to add sand, which is very costly, but you see that a lot in Southern California, example. You truck in sand from elsewhere and just replenish the beaches every summer and just keep it wide and sandy for recreation, but that sand is coming from somewhere else and it means somewhere else is losing sand. And the third option is to relocate and migrate inland with the water, pick up a home and move it further inland, move Pacific Coast Highway half a mile further inland, which is something that we did by Hearst Castle. You know, and it really boils down to these three choices, and they're all tough. They all have their own consequences. They're all unpopular in their own ways, and it just, it gets messy.
Well, and just here locally, you wrote about the city of Pacifica on our coast just south of San Francisco, and that seemed to be an example of the politics of this really making these hard choices that much more difficult, where you had a convergence of developers and homeowners and environmental groups. You had a mayor who lost his mayorship over this issue, and in part because he was talking about managed retreat, the sort of retreating away from the coastline, that third option that you were just describing. So can you talk a little bit about Pacifica and what that city is facing? And sort of how that's maybe a bit of a harbinger of the future for the rest of the state?
Yeah, and Pacifica is an interesting one because they also have a lot of neighborhoods on cliffs, which is also a part of kind of this erosion, sea level rise issue. And I think what was interesting in Pacifica is just everyone loved the city, and I think that this conversation about sea level rise and what it means to face sea level rise into the future became also this conversation about what the future of Pacifica was all about and whether or not Pacifica will survive into the future. And I think the largest disagreement was really how much more time the city had. It's a less gentrified town relatively to kind of some of the coastal towns I'm more familiar with in Southern California. I mean, I think I would say a large cohort down there thinks that there is still a lot of opportunity to develop really cute restaurants along the shore and have a downtown with coffee shops and bookstores. And, you know, I think that their home values are still good. And so they say, why retreat a good thing before it's time? And I think the other half is saying that the Mother Ocean has already taken over. We are just battling a moot cause. And on top of that, we are just going to continue sacrificing beaches and natural wetlands and all these other natural ecosystems as we try to kind of hold our ground and maintain a city and grow a city, and that is just a moot point. So it was interesting to kind of see the gentrification and kind of existential existence conversations coinciding and becoming the sea level rise question in Pacifica. And obviously that led into politics and a lot of interesting stakeholders kind of coming to the table and disagreeing on some key issues.
Yeah, it's a good example of just how complicated it is. Even when everyone acknowledges there's a problem, that they're still arriving at a solution, it can be really elusive. And you mentioned the three solutions, a seawall. And a lot of people might say, well, you know, why don't we just build a bunch of seawalls? That should take care of it. I mean, how effective is that as an option to combat sea level rise?
So that is a question that different people will give you different answers. I think the seawall that most listeners would be familiar with is the Embarcadero in San Francisco. That is one gigantic seawall. And that seawall is a century old. They just, the city just passed a measure to spend $450 million just to rebuild the foundation of part of that seawall. So it's an expensive endeavor to maintain. And they last only as long as you're willing to maintain it. And I think the other half of it is they're controversial because, as one environmentalist put it to me, seawalls kill beaches. They create that hard line in the sand, and as the water moves further inland, it drowns out the entire beach in front of it. So on the bay side of San Francisco, there are no beaches in front of the Embarcadero. And I think that is a conversation for the community. What do you want to sacrifice and what do you want to protect? Because I think the decision in San Francisco on the bay side is that the Embarcadero protects, you know, assets that are just something that you cannot sacrifice in terms of the financial district, the port, and everything that San Francisco stands for. So those are really interesting questions of value and what you want to protect and what you're willing to sacrifice.
All right. Well, we want to hear from listeners that we're opening the phone lines now. If you're living close to the coast, have you faced flooding or erosion of the beaches near you? And have you been advised or mandated or chosen to move? We also want to hear from you if you have thoughts about what should be done to protect the future of the California coast. You can call in to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. You can also post comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. And the number again is 866-798-TALK. And we're talking to Rosanna Shaw, environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Rosanna, I want to ask you about the second maybe solution to sea level rise to addressing this problem. I mean, first we have the seawalls that you mentioned, but what about natural infrastructure? I mean, are there other solutions that we could be putting in place besides a hardening of the coast?
Yeah, I think natural infrastructure, living shorelines, you'll kind of hear those terms a lot, is building a lot of buzz and political momentum. And, you know, there's different definitions for it, but the way I think about it, it's kind of like what a seawall would do in terms of dissipating wave energy and storm surges before they actually get to the infrastructure on the shore, but using kind of artificial reefs or marshes and other natural methods to block off the rising sea or at least dissipate some of the energy as it's coming in. And I think that it is a popular choice, but it's also one that, like seawalls, requires maintenance and it requires a lot of agreement and forward thinking. And it's a solution, but it's not necessarily the ultimate long-range solution based on the people that I've spoken to, because ultimately the ocean will move inland to a point where you're going to have to rethink how you want to restructure your coastline.
All right, well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Craig from Palo Alto on the line. Craig, welcome to your call.
Hello. I'm not sure whether mitigation effects or attempts are going to do much about this because it's the sea is going to rise. What I'm concerned about is this. There just seems to be a lack of urgency on the part of the American public, I mean, at least large sections of it, to trying to address the whole issue of global warming. And I live in a community that's very affluent where there's just unbelievable development going on. And I don't know how you stop this. I mean, I would have had to commit civil disobedience to try and stop a development project in Palo Alto. And nobody down here in the staff or the city council seem to be concerned about the levels of pollution that are coming from this. So I just don't know what it's going to take to get masses of people, you know, engaging in direct action to try and stop the increasing level of pollutants and CO2. So I wonder if your guest has any ideas.
Sure. And Greg, I would just note that housing near jobs, such as in Palo Alto, is actually a very positive climate strategy. So in terms of development there, it may not always be bad. But Rosanna, why don't you weigh in on Craig's larger point about, you know, putting more urgency into this issue of climate change and with sea level rise being one of the leading indicators here.
Yeah, Craig, thank you for that. I mean, I think that we as a society were just not really good at mobilizing before a disaster, only after. And you think about Katrina and Superstorm Sandy and all of the wildfires. And I think the scary thing about climate change is that it's a disaster that's been happening, is happening, and will continue to happen, but it's so slow relatively that I worry too with you on what it would take to mobilize an entire community, an entire state, an entire country, an entire world to really think about it. And I think in California, what's interesting, and you'll hear the people who've been working in this space for a long time note that, you know, there are two approaches that we have to tackle when it comes to addressing climate change. One is mitigation, so cutting emissions and really setting standards that will not continue to make global warming go at the rate that it's going. And then the other half is adaptation. What do you do about the changes and the risks and the hazards that are already built in, you know, with sea level rise, for example? And I think that in California, one could argue that we focus a lot on mitigation. We're really aggressive about setting emission standards. We're really kind of trying to dominate that conversation in that space, and that's great. But I think that we are definitely struggling with the adaptation portion of it. And I think that to be able to be effectively aware of climate change and to tackle it head on, we have to be good about both. You know, how do we avoid continuing to make mistakes that we've been making, and how do we address and adapt to the mistakes that we have made and will not change, even if we ignore it?
All right. Well, thank you, Craig, for calling in with that question. And, Rosanna, I wanted to ask you, you know, this question about not really thinking about this long term. I mean, what should be done in terms of long term planning? I mean, this isn't just a Pacifica issue. You wrote about Gleason Beach or Imperial Beach down south. I mean, what should we be doing as a state in terms of long term planning to address this this looming crisis here?
Yeah, and I think, I hope my article highlighted this a little bit, but what I found in my reporting is that this issue is still pretty uncoordinated across California, even though many cities up and down the coast are already thinking about it. So I think that there was kind of a call to action from a lot of local officials and experts and planners for the state to take more of a leadership role in just moving this issue forward from a statewide perspective. And that's tough because every community is a little bit different. Every community struggles with a little bit of different topography. But I think that to start this long-term planning effort, the first step is to identify your risks and figure out which areas will be underwater by, you know, what level of rise. And I think figuring out what to do about those areas and talk as a community, what do we want our coast to look like in the future? How badly do we want to protect this beach? Do we want to protect this stretch of Pacific Coast Highway? How badly do we need this treatment plant or other critical infrastructure that we've built along the coast? I think these conversations need to happen, and I think that there needs to be movement in terms of studying what our vulnerabilities are and what our timeline is to realistically address these vulnerabilities.
All right. Well, we've got George calling in from San Francisco. George, welcome to your call.
Hey, good morning. You know, I may have missed it, so stop me if this is a repetition. There's a bridge every here and there along the coast of California, which ships have to pass under. And has anybody calculated how many of those ships, if any, are going to have no space under the bridge?
Oh, okay. You're talking about the Golden Gate Bridge, I assume, and maybe down in Long Beach, there's a bridge there as well.
Quite a few bridges in San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, sure. So, Rosanna, is that an issue that sea level rise could be so great that it could actually impact you know, freight transportation, marine vessels?
You know, that is a great question, and I had not thought about it from that perspective. What I do know is that, especially on the Golden Gate Bridge, the Army Corps of Engineers has been dredging sand out of the bay for years because they already have that issue with bridges, with ships needing to go under that bridge. And there's actually been kind of this interesting battle about who gets that dredged sand and which beaches could get nourished from that dredged sand. And I've been so focused on the where does that sand go part of the question that I hadn't thought about the ship part. But that's a great question, and George and I will look into it. But yeah, it's very interesting to think about what it would mean to have ships come in and out of the port, because the Port of San Francisco is the gateway for so much of the world and California, and we absolutely would need to have ships continue to go in and out of the port if we want our life the way it is right now to continue.
All right. Well, thank you, George, for that question. And last question for you, Rosanna. We're just about out of time. Is were there any great examples that you can point to in your reporting of how this should be done? I mean, any sort of positive stories about what we can chart as a path forward here as a state?
Ooh, good question. I really wanted to find a solution, and there wasn't a one-size-fits-all solution. I think that one legislative solution or one kind of policy thing, and, you know, apologies for being a little bit more wonky on this one, but the one kind of clear thing was we have all these really powerful disclosures in California at the real estate transaction level when it comes to buying a house in a wildfire zone or earthquake zone. I used to cover earthquakes, and I think that we are pretty educated publicly about what it means to own property or live in a hazard zone when it comes to earthquakes and wildfires. And I don't think we have that same level of awareness with sea level rise and flooding. And I think a number of people I spoke to said that it would be really powerful just to have a disclosure component when it comes to just disclosing homes that are along the coast that might be subject to sea level rise and other really tough decisions further down the road. And I think that that would really begin this public awareness component, because I don't think most people living along the coast right now are thinking about anything besides the really pretty ocean view and not thinking as much about what it means to have that ocean come closer and
sure.
closer
well,
to
I think,
your home.
I think your reporting is definitely helping to change that conversation. We're going to have to leave it at that. Rosanna Shaw, environment reporter covering the California coastline for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Happy to be on. Thank you.
All right. And after the break, we're going to be talking about the Trump administration's proposed rollback to the Endangered Species Act. So stay tuned for that right after this break. All right. For those of you joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Now, we're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So now we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about the Trump administration's proposed plans to drastically revise and weaken the Federal Endangered Species Act, which is hailed as one of the nation's most important wildlife conservation laws. Now, this new rule comes at a time when scientists are warning of a mass extinction of species. In fact, it would be the sixth in our planet's history, according to our scientific records. Now, a recent UN report warned that as many as 1 million species are at risk of extinction, many within decades. So this is a very pressing issue, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. To discuss this further, we're joined on the phone from Chicago by Rebecca Riley, who is legal director at the Nature Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. Rebecca, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we also want to hear from you. We're going to open the phone lines probably in about 15 minutes, and that number to call will be 866-798-TALK. But you can email any questions you have now at yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. You can also post comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. That's all while you're waiting for the phone lines to open. And Rebecca, let me begin by asking you to just remind us and describe a bit about just what the Endangered Species Act is. I think, you know, a lot of people hear about it or may not have heard about it, and, you know, we just want to have some general sense of how it operates, because I think most people don't really know the details here.
Sure. So the Endangered Species Act is one of our most successful environmental laws. It has helped hundreds of species recover from the brink of extinction. It was actually passed back in 1973 by overwhelming bipartisan majorities of Congress and signed into law by Richard Nixon. And what it aims to do is to help species that are in trouble recover and come back to healthy population levels. Some examples of species that it has successfully saved are bald eagles, the Florida manatee, grizzly bears, and gray wolves.
So there's a lot of success stories that you can point to. And it's interesting when you note that, you know, this was a bipartisan act. Richard Nixon signed it into law, as you mentioned. So what happened? When did Republicans in particular start a campaign to really roll back this law that they had at one time supported?
That's right. The interesting thing is Americans overwhelmingly still support the Endangered Species Act. 90% of the American public says they support this law and they support protecting species and preventing their extinction. And that's a really overwhelming majority for any issue. But on Capitol Hill, and it has become this hot button issue. And that's because polluters like the oil and gas industry, the logging industry, mining interests would like this law to be weaker. And they want that because that makes it easier for them to do things that damage important wildlife habitat.
And, you know, this is part of a sort of a larger scale rollback that that the Trump administration and its allies among Republican members of Congress has been kind of waging. And one of the arguments they make is that, you know, the act hasn't been all that successful, that there's only been a few species that have actually been delisted or removed because of success. What is your response to that argument that the act really hasn't, you know, brought back some of these key populations at numbers that might justify the costs?
Sure. So there are two ways to talk about the success of the law. And the first thing to know is it has prevented the extinction of 99% of the species it protects. So the good news is the law is very, very successful at its goal of preventing species extinction. And while it's true it hasn't recovered all of the species on the list, that's because recovery takes a long time. It takes about 45 years to recover species to a healthy population level. It also requires resources, and Congress for years has been failing to fund the Fish and Wildlife Service and all of the resources they need to actually do the work that's necessary to recover species.
All right, let's talk a little bit about now what the Trump administration is proposing here. Can you describe what these new rules would do?
Sure. So what the rules are designed to do is to make it harder to list species as threatened or endangered, to remove protections for their habitat, and to exempt climate change impacts from many parts of the law.
And who exactly do you have a sense of who is pushing this change? I mean, we know it's Republicans proposing it, but, you know, are there specific groups that seem to be – that sort of seem to have their fingerprints on these rule changes here?
Absolutely. So the head of the Department of Interior right now is David Bernhardt. He is a former oil and gas industry lobbyist, and there's no question that the oil and gas industry and similar extractive industries are behind the push to weaken wildlife protection laws.
All right, and I want to get into some of the nuts and bolts here of these changes. I mean, you talk about how removing tools that officials use to predict future harms as a result of climate change. I mean, how would that play out? I mean, can you kind of walk us through an example of how these rules would play out?
Sure. So one of the things that they're doing is they're exempting climate change impacts from certain protections of the law. And one of those protections is called critical habitat. This is the one part of the law that specifically protects certain areas of an endangered species habitat. And what the new rule says is if your habitat is critical habitat or could be threatened by climate change, whether by sea ice loss or sea level rise, we're not going to designate that habitat critical habitat. And you can imagine why that's a real problem here. There are species that live in coastal habitats that are threatened by sea level rise. And if we can't take steps to protect that habitat now, we're going to have very little hope of saving that species and recovering it to healthy population levels.
And are there any particular species that we should be particularly concerned about with this change? You mentioned that animals along the coast, some plants as well, but any ones that really jump out at you as now particularly at risk if this change were to go through?
The western snowy plover is a bird species that is primarily threatened by sea level rise because its habitat lies along the coast, and that's a species that will get very little protection under these rule changes because we won't be able to protect that habitat as from sea level rise.
And another aspect of this rule is the introduction of basically changing how we look at the financial costs, or adding in an element of looking at the financial costs of protecting these endangered or threatened species. Can you describe a bit about how that changes some of the analysis that might be done under the Act moving forward?
Yes. So the Endangered Species Act is very clear that decisions about whether a species should be listed as endangered need to be based on science. What the Trump administration is moving to do is to inject economic considerations into those decisions. And that's obviously going to skew decision-making. You could have, for example, a species that lives somewhere where the oil and gas industry wants to drill, and all of a sudden, it might not receive the protections it otherwise would be entitled to.
And, again, same question. Are there specific species now that you think, are going to be particularly at risk with this type of change about introducing a financial analysis where there wasn't one before?
No particular species comes to mind. This change is the kind of change we're looking at for species that are not yet listed. Oh, I did think of one. The monarch butterfly is actually a classic case. It's a species that has not yet been listed, but the Fish and Wildlife Service is looking at listing it. And if they inject economic considerations into listing, it could skew the decision-making process and lead them not to list it, despite the fact that we've lost about 90% of its population.
And so monarch butterfly is obviously a good example for those of us here in California. We're already, you know, I went down to Pacific Grove to see the trees where the monarch butterflies were supposed to be, and there were just a few left, you know, compared to thousands from, you know, not even that many years ago. And so are there specific areas of the country that are going to be more where species are going to be more at risk because of this change? I mean, is this sort of a bigger change for high-cost areas where critical habitat might be more valuable? Just wondering if, you know, how this plays out geographically.
I think anywhere where you have an industry, whether it's mining or oil and gas or timber, who will be able to quantify the value of, you know, extraction, that you're going to have this skewing effect go into play. You know, and the way the Endangered Species Act has worked for years actually doesn't fully stop those things. That's the thing we should know. The Endangered Species Act just makes sure that we do things like oil and gas drilling in a way that minimizes the impact on species. And so these two things can coexist, right? We can have development, but we can also have species protections. But the Trump rollbacks would lead to us just completely ignoring species protections and letting, you know, the timber industry go ahead and log an area where an important species may live.
All right. Well, for those of you just joining us now, this is Your Call's One Planet series, and we're discussing the Trump administration's proposed plans to drastically roll back aspects of the Endangered Species Act. And we're joined on the phone from Chicago by Rebecca Riley, who is legal director for the Nature Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And we want to open the phone lines to you and hear your questions. What questions do you have about the Endangered Species Act? Are you worried about the fate of any particular plant or animal species right here in the Bay Area or elsewhere along the West Coast? To join the conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@klw.org. Tweet us at yourcallradio. You can also post comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca, you mentioned that this financial analysis, this economic impacts analysis, is sort of being injected into the process for evaluating endangered species protection going forward, but it didn't sound like it was in the original law. So how is it, how much legal basis is there for these changes that the Trump administration is proposing?
Not much. Not only is that economic consideration not in the original law, but the law prohibits it. And even the Trump administration admits this. What they're trying to say is that they're going to talk about economic considerations, but not look at them. But we all know that doesn't make any sense. The point of this change is to illegally inject dollar signs into what's supposed to be a fully scientific analysis of whether a species is at risk of extinction.
And so we know there's going to be legal challenges, and it sounds like California Attorney General Xavier Becerra is going to be filing suit. And I know that I'm sure your organization and other environmental organizations are planning to as well, if you haven't already. So what's the prospect now for the litigation going forward on this on these proposed rules?
There will be a lawsuit. There will be a coalition of environmental groups, a coalition of states. And the legal claims will be strong. And that's because when this administration changes the rules, they tend not to follow the law. And, you know, they do that in all sorts of ways. You know, for example, sometimes the law is very clear on something like this economic considerations, and they just ignore it. Other times, you know, they make a change, but they don't explain why they made that change in a rational way. What the law says is an administration can change the rules, but it has to be justified and it has to be rational. And we don't think that the administration has shown that these changes are.
And so what's the likely timeline of this litigation? I mean, these disputes, it seems like they can take years to resolve. So could it be that we don't even get a final answer on this until we have a new president after 2020 if the election goes against Trump?
So the lawsuit will probably be filed fairly shortly and could be resolved within the next year or so. If it's appealed, it could take a little bit longer. But that first round in the district court, we should be able to resolve that within months to a year.
So, and it seems like the other aspect of litigation against the Trump administration is that environmental organizations have had a really high success rate. So, I mean, I was noticing that something like 95% of the environmental challenges filed against some of the Trump administration policies on public lands have been held up by the courts against the Trump administration, that they've been sort of sloppy on the science, they've been sloppy on their drafting. I mean, can we sort of feel confident that environmental organizations like NRDC kind of have the environment's back in this case, and we don't really have to worry about it because they're doing a bad job at the administration with their rollbacks? Or is there, you know, the possibility that this could actually survive some of these challenges?
There's no question that this administration has been sloppy time and time again, and they don't base their decisions on science. And the good news about our environmental laws is they consistently require scientific, rational decision making. And so if the Trump administration ignores the science, which they have done here, and ignores, you know, they don't dot their I's, they don't cross their T's, that makes it much easier for environmental groups like ours to take them to court and to win.
And is there a chance this could go all the way to the Supreme Court?
There's always a chance.
So we know the Trump administration's already had two picks of those nine justices. So I guess you can't feel too confident in terms of the environmental side, how that would play out there. And so what are the opportunity costs of what they're doing? In other words, you know, by proposing this, are they taking up resources away from environmental organizations, fighting these battles that would be spent kind of doing more proactive steps? Does this suspend any rules currently so that at least industry and others benefiting from this rule are getting some short-term value out of creating this controversy and this litigation? I mean, I'm kind of wondering what their short-term benefits are by proposing these rules, given the litigation risk and given, you know, the idea that they're not doing a solid job and this may not hold up, but that in the meantime they're just plowing ahead.
Well, they are hopeful as ever that these rules will hold up. And David Bernhardt actually was part of the Bush administration and tried to pass, put out Environmental Endangered Species Act regulations at the end of that administration as well. Those did not hold up, so he's trying again. Their hope is that somehow they can get this by the courts and that they will weaken wildlife protections forever. Now, the good news is we do have the courts. And even if we don't have the courts, another administration could take steps to roll these back.
All right. Well, we do want to remind listeners that the phone lines are open. If you have questions about the Endangered Species Act, we'd love to hear from you. To join the conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org and tweet us at yourcallradio and post comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. And we're joined by Rebecca Riley, legal director for the Nature Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, to talk about these proposed rollbacks to the Endangered Species Act that the Trump administration has proposed. And, you know, a little more background on the Endangered Species Act, Rebecca. Are there any particular successes that, you know, your organization likes to trumpet as a good example of how the act has worked well?
Absolutely. The bald eagle, which, you know, is a symbol of our country, was once on the brink of extinction. Back in the 1970s, there were very few left. And it is a success story. We were able to recover its population to healthy levels, and it no longer is listed under the Endangered Species Act because it no longer needs the law's protections. And that's what we're aiming for here across the board. We want successful species recoveries so that we can take species off the list because they aren't on the brink of extinction anymore.
And, you know, I have to ask another question about the Endangered Species Act. You know, I guess most people might assume that it's sort of universally supported by the environmental community. But in fact, there have been a lot of conflicts between the Endangered Species Act and some of our efforts to fight climate change. And a good example of that might be some renewable energy projects, wind farms, solar fields, et cetera, that have had roadblocks because of potential impacts to the Endangered Species Act. And then some people say, well, look, if we don't address the climate problem, all these species species, including our own, are going to be at risk here from the changing climate. So isn't it more important that we find clean ways to generate our energy and from renewable and wind, just as an example? So how do you address those questions, those kind of splits within the environmental community, particularly on this issue of clean technology deployment to fight climate change?
Well, the good news is there's a way to do both. We can deploy wind and solar and do it in smart ways that has the least potential impact on species. And that's by siting it outside of important habitat areas and applying mitigation measures wherever necessary to mitigate any adverse effects it has on wildlife.
And, you know, another aspect of the Endangered Species Act that gets talked about is this sort of charismatic animal, charismatic fauna. You know, the idea that you have a very, you know, adorable sea otter or bald eagle, but that in fact the act, you know, there are a lot of species that may not look as appealing to human beings, you know, the average person, but are still really central. And so, how do you combat that? You know, when there's a project that's being held up over some really tiny animal, you know, I think a lot of people kind of throw their hands up and say this has gotten a little out of hand. And so, how do you address that sort of public perception and that public concern about how far the act goes?
Well, the thing to know is that the endangered species rarely, if ever completely stops a project. What it does is it makes developers pause and take a look at things like siting, whether, you know, you're building a road, where do we put it, or, you know, mitigation, taking every step possible that to minimize the impact on species. Because, you know, just like we talked about with the wind industry, we can build a road and we can do it in a smarter way that avoids these sensitive habitat areas. And that's what the Endangered Species Act aims to do. It doesn't aim to stop development. It aims to make sure that development is done in a smart way.
And although the critical habitat provisions are pretty strict, right? I mean, if an area is designated as critical habitat, it's hard to build a project on it. Isn't that right?
That's actually not the case. While it sounds like it might provide that level of protection, it actually is flexible in that you can build in certain cases in critical habitat, but you have to take a look at the impact you're having, and you have to try to minimize and mitigate that impact.
And are there examples of smart development that you could point to, you know, examples of where, you know, we have had a win-win with protecting endangered species, but also, you know, moving forward with projects that are done in a responsible way?
I think the renewable energy industry is a good example. They do reach out to talk about siting, to talk about where to build wind turbines to decrease the impact on species.
There's some examples right there for listeners who want to know how we can have good development going forward with the Endangered Species Act and smart development, as you pointed to. So another question, too, just in terms of the mechanics of the law. So you talked about species that are listed and then delisted. Who gets to decide when a species is listed as endangered or threatened and when it's been deemed to have recovered enough to be delisted?
So the interesting thing is any American can petition for a species to be looked at and considered for listing. Often the petitions come from organizations like NRDC, because we have scientists on staff who can do that, who can explain, you know, the threats to the species and why it should be listed as endangered. Ultimately, the two agencies responsible for making the decision are the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is part of the Department of Interior, and the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is part of the Department of Commerce. Those agencies make the ultimate call on whether to list a species and then ultimately to delist a species if it's recovered to a healthy level.
And I know sometimes that can be controversial, too, and that environmental organizations have to get involved. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this rollback on the terms of Endangered Species Act is just part of an overall effort to benefit certain business groups at the expense of environmental values in this country. And are there other policy moves that you're monitoring or that have been set in motion that also affect endangered species, but maybe not through the Endangered Species Act? Like, what else is the administration doing that you're sort of monitoring on this issue?
Sure. So About a year ago, the administration rolled back another wildlife law, actually one of our oldest wildlife laws, called the Migratory Bird Protection Act, Treaty Act. And that law protects migratory birds across the country. And the Trump administration gutted that law as well. We've already filed a lawsuit, and we just won the first round of briefing. And so we're fighting to get that rollback reversed.
All right. Well, good conversation here. We just have time for one last thought from you. What's the next steps? What are you looking forward to, or what should we be all looking toward to, I should say, rather than forward to, in terms of the Endangered Species Act and protecting these species going forward?
The next thing that will happen is we will be filing a lawsuit, the states will file a lawsuit, and we'll take the Trump administration on in court.
All right. Well, you heard it here. This is Your Call's One Planet series. We were joined on the phone from Chicago by Rebecca Riley, who's legal director for the Nature Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. We always appreciate those. And you can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Today's show was produced by Malihe Razazan. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.